And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry. I'm delighted to be joined by Radney Foster today. Radney Foster is a popular and critically acclaimed country music singer and songwriter. He was a member of the duo Foster and Lloyd and has released many well-received solo albums like Del Rio, Texas 1959 and The World We Live In. He has also recently joined the ranks of American fiction writers with his first collection of short stories, For You to See the Stars, which is published by Working Title Farm, which is the new publishing imprint from author Sherry Smith. And there is a companion album with a song for each of the stories, also called For You to See the Stars, and it's available from Devil's River Records. But of course, the big obvious question that you have to answer over and over and over again is, why have you turned your hand to writing?
It wasn't that I hadn't written prose before, but most of the prose that I had written before was in a journalistic manner. I would get asked every now and then to write something for Guitar Player magazine or Acoustic Guitar magazine. I did a whole series of four different articles on alternate tunings and songwriting and that kind of thing. But putting my hand to fiction had not really crossed my mind until about 3 years ago. 3 years ago, I went through a real soul searching about, you know, what is it that I really do? And I actually walked through for a day with my good friend, Darden Smith, who's also a Texas singer-songwriter, and, you know, said, I need to walk through this with a friend and sort of distill what it is I do and why do I do it and, you know, what are the reasons besides, you know, lining pockets. You know, the wolf is at the door. You have to pay for college education. You're trying to figure out retirement at my age and all those kinds of things. And so
you got in the lucrative world of fiction.
Yeah, right? that made all the lucrative world of short fiction. That made all the sense in the world, right? No, what I really discovered was that I'm a storyteller. And so I started asking myself, in what ways am I telling stories? And in what ways am I not telling stories that I should be? Shortly thereafter, without it being, you know, solidified in my mind, I got pneumonia and laryngitis so bad that I was not allowed to talk at all for 6 weeks. And then I had to go through another 6 weeks of physical therapy before we could ever book any gigs. So that was 3 months off, and that is an existential crisis for a guy who sings for a living. And literally 2 weeks in, I was going, well, what if it never comes back? And so I thought, well, how would I, you know, continue to do something I love, which is storytelling? And about 6 months before that, I'd written a song called Sycamore Creek, and I wrote a note to my wife and said, you know, I think there's a short story in that song, and I'm going to write it to keep from going crazy. And she literally wrote back down on the piece of paper, I wish I still had it, but she said, that's good because you're driving me crazy. So I wrote it, and then with a lot of fear and trepidation, you know, handed it to her, and she said, it's really good. You know, you need to think about continuing to do this. And she's my toughest critic. She was a journalist and a magazine editor for many, many years. She definitely is the kind of person who would hold my feet to the fire. And she has more than on one occasion saying, you don't need to put that song out. You know, so I know that she can be completely honest. And so that started me really thinking about it. By the time I'd written about five or six more, I kind of had the thought process of doing a book of short fiction with a song to go with each story in the book.
So in sequencing the album and the stories, which one took the lead?
Well, the stories took the lead. I remember sort of this awkward moment on my part being stuck in the middle because Sherry Smith at Working Title Farm, who is my publisher, had sort of one idea. And then Will Kimbrough, who is my record producer, had another. But Will really said, you know, Radney, this is your 11th solo record, and, you know, your audience is going to follow you regardless of what the sequencing of this record is at this point. And he said, so I'm really going to defer to her. But Sherry, her only adamancies were that the first story be For You to See the Stars, and that the last story be Sycamore Creek, and that Bridge Club be Close to the Front. Other than that, she was pretty happy. So from there, it was just sort of listening and seeing how that all would fit together with those bookends.
See, I've always thought that the title track from an album should be the first song on the second side of the LP.
Well, you know, yeah, I have done that before, and I certainly have that. I can agree with that on a song level. But in a book of short fiction generally, you know, you want the marketing of the first story they read should be the title story. And
I know a lot of folks that put them at the very end.
Yeah, and that was a thought process at one point too. But she really felt like that the stories both shined in different ways and showed a really different part of myself as a prose writer. And that was her. She said, you know, we can argue. I'm not the last word. It is your book, you know. But when I read them that way, it made sense, you know.
And they bookend nicely.
Yeah.
Could you kind of compare and contrast what an editor does compared to a record producer?
Okay, I'm sorry. That's a normal thing and it shouldn't crack me up. But having been a record producer for lots of other people as well, you know, my favorite thing as a record producer is to create an atmosphere that is conducive to creativity in the studio and to really go through the material with the artist and, you know, sort of workshop the arrangements. But then you know that you're going to get in there and some guy's going to play something that's magical that you never dreamt in your head, who's one of the musicians, and you go, oh, whoa, 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 wait a second. That's a whole lot cooler than what we thought we were going to do. We're going to scrap what we were doing. We're going to do what he's doing because it's really cool. And to me, that seems like such an intuitive thing. I'm not in there telling someone to rewrite a second verse. You know, it's very rare for me to sort of interrupt into that level of intimacy. And yet an editor does that fairly consistently. You know, they're going to look at your paragraph. And even on a good level, for me, before we ever really got to the real editing process, was that I could send something to Sherry and she would say, this is where you're singing. And I don't think it was accidental that she would use that verb when she was working with me. I think she thought that that was something that would resonate. And it's certainly something that people talk about, you know, the word singing off the page and that kind of thing from a literary standpoint. But I think she chose that word wisely because she could tell me, it's like, this is where you're singing. This is where you're not. Go make the parts that aren't. Sing like that other stuff. You know, and so, you know, having that kind of coaching, you know, as you're getting through the first or second draft of something was really awesome for me. And then the wonderful part about editing this book, and I know it's rare that it happens this way, it used to happen more often this way, but we sat across her kitchen table and I read her the stories and she would edit. I'd given her the manuscripts beforehand, but she said, all right, now read it to me. And half the time I would find things where I'd go, oh, wait a second. Because it was just like, I'm telling a story. I'm reading it out loud, even though it's a different characters or whether it's written in third person or first person or, you know, those things. There was something magical about reading it. To me, it made sense in my brain because I sing for a living. You know, I write the songs to sing them. So the word was written to the page to be spoken in a way.
But was there any sense of melody while you were writing that you could hear?
No, not at all. That would be a distraction. And I know that there's a lot of writers who talk about that they listen to music. I've had writers write to me, you know, send me an email and say, you know, I listened to this whole record, you know, while I was writing my book. And I'm like, how the hell do you do that? Because it would be such a distraction to me. Because I would get lost in that. You know, being a guy who makes music for a living, maybe I listen to it a little differently, if that makes any sense.
It seemed like you'd be more engaged with it.
It's very hard for me to passively listen to stuff and have conversation like you're at a cocktail party. I mean, I can do it and I do it, certainly. But I still love that, you know, that I just listen to a record. These days, the time that I do most of my listening is either in a car, when I'm making dinner for my family. There's something about, you know, being in the kitchen alone for that 30 or 40 minutes. It's just enough time to be able to put on a great Tom Petty record, God rest his soul, and, you know, flip it over while the onions are sautéing.
Okay, pick one Tom Petty song, since everyone's doing that
now. Oh, my gosh. That's hard. It really might be American Girl. And the funny thing is, that's not what I first heard, because I know that was a lot of people my generation's, you know, first hearing of him was to hear that song a little bit on the radio, and I didn't discover him until Damn the Torpedoes. And so I went back and bought that record and was just floored by it. It was exactly what I wanted to do as a songwriter. It was working man's poetry, roll your sleeves up. You can understand it. You can see it. You can picture it.
Yeah, but you and Petty are both are smarter than the average bear.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment, you know.
And what's the chef's specialty when you're cooking for your family?
I have several, but, you know, I bet the one that is most requested by them is bœuf bourguignon. My oldest lived in France for 13 years with his mom, and we would go visit, and I learned there was a woman who pretty consistently rented a house to us so that, you know, we could, you know, be mom and dad for a week and take them to school and have a parent-teacher meeting. Having a parent-teacher meeting in French, by the way, is the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life. So, yeah. But she taught me her family's bœuf bourguignon recipe, and it's a knockout. So,
I mean, red wine and beef. What
yeah, it's
want,
hard right? to go wrong, right?
Earlier, you had mentioned writing for the guitar magazine about alternate tunings and how they might change your songwriting. Mm-hmm. In the collection of stories here, it's unusual that I didn't expect you to write a science fiction story or a spy thriller story. I just, you know, expected slices of right. Southwestern life. So do you think doing those genres are kind of similar to alternate tuning?
Absolutely, they are. And I knew the retired spy story, which for the listener who hasn't read, is really a bar hop with a retired spy in New Orleans. I love New Orleans, and I have for many years, and I've gone there a lot and have played there a lot. And I knew that I wanted to set something in New Orleans. Most of the setting and the sense of place is really informed by West Texas in most of the other stories. But I knew I wanted to offer up a couple of different things really based around the songs. And so we were taking my second oldest, my wife's firstborn, to look at colleges. And we spent 3 or 4 days in New Orleans looking at schools. And I knew that I was going to find a sense of place out of that whole experience, and I would go out and just wander and do character studies of people sitting at the bar, just recording what they're saying. The opening of that about hiding things in plain sight. New Orleans is a place where you can really hide things in plain sight, and that's what spies do. And also, I was informed by the song. I knew I needed something to go with this song that was titled "I'm Done with the Past, but It Ain't Done with Me." And what better way than someone who's served his country, you know, with valor, but in secret, and how much all those secrets can kind of unravel your life if you're not careful.
The science fiction story.
I don't know how much to say. It's sort of just dystopian literature.
Any alternate future type
stuff. Yeah, any alternate future is
speculative fiction.
Speculative fiction.
The United American Republic is going to attack Denver, Colorado.
That's correct. And the city-state of Denver.
And we have an affiliate in the Four Corners area in Farmington, Mexico, right across from Durango.
Oh, wow.
So tell us about what's going to happen to Denver when it all goes down.
Well, without any spoilers, it's really about a soldier in a society that has really been at war and without the constitutional guarantees that he would have had as a citizen of the United States of America, and the unraveling of society because of it, and how much it sort of leads to perpetual war, that war has been going on for 20 years. It wasn't that much of a stretch to me. I actually just took laws that were on the books in different countries around the world as far as citizenship is concerned, and then how militaries work from different affiliations around the world, not just our own, and sort of doing that research. I knew it needed to write something that was dystopian just because of the song it was attached to. And that was kind of interesting. That was the one song where I almost gave up. I thought I may not put that on the record, although I think it's a very powerful song. It's called, a song called All That I Require. And I had put it out just as a single before our most recent election because I was hearing so many voices of extremism, and in particular fascism, in our modern political discourse. So I took to write the song, I took nothing but sloganeering from despots both on the left and the right from the 1930s, and I strung them together into an allegorical song, sort of as a cautionary tale. It really resonated with a lot of fans and a lot of people, and so I was stumped for quite some time as to how I could make something stick with that song. And so it really was sort of leaving my comfort zone, and it took a lot more research than I had first envisioned that I would have needed for any of the stories. But I really, in order to pull that one off, I really had to research military hierarchy, not only in our own country, but in others, and how militaries are influenced whenever you have a caste society within a particular country. Certainly, I looked into a bunch of, you know, South American banana republics or dictatorships, but then also, you know, the country of India has a caste system, and yet, even though it you know, their government tries as hard as it can to squelch it, it still exists. And so how the hell does that affect military readiness? How does that deal with officer versus enlisted man? If you know that because of your caste, your opportunities to become an officer just are somewhere. They may legally be there, but they are essentially between slim and none. So I became informed by all that stuff. It became one of the more fascinating things to write.
Because it did have echoes of Starship Troopers by Heinlein. But service means citizenship.
And rightly so. I mean, there was a part of me that I said, well, certainly can't go back and read any Orwell right now because I'm going to just be, I don't want to lift anything, you know. And I think the ultimate thing that fed the story was for me to put myself into the shoes of three people, two of them sergeants, certainly the two main characters, the sergeant and the captain, but then also Sergeant Clemente. You know, here's a guy who's been raised in, whose parents, his whole family background is from Denver. And yet he is waiting in the cold in the dead of winter in February to take Denver by siege.
It also addresses our current divide in America.
Sure.
And that so much of our political divide seems to be based on cities versus rural areas.
Absolutely. And that was not lost on me. And if you noted the breakup of the United States, you know, it breaks up into three main states and sort of some city states on top of that. And it was fun and arduous at the same time to write and hard to think about. And I had to make myself really go, well, what do we take for granted as far as the freedoms that we have? And how would altering one or more of them only slightly really, really change our society?
So where are you bugging out to when it all goes down?
I don't know. You know, I have no idea. I hope it doesn't. I hope to God that what I've written is nothing but fantastical fiction. And, you know, people will say, oh, well, that's a fine cautionary tale, but thank God it never took place.
But you do have more of an insight than some people do, since you grew up in a rural area.
Sure.
On a border area.
Oh, yeah.
And
my house was a mile from Mexico growing up. And
take that, Sarah Palin.
I literally could say, I could ride my bike to the border, you know. And so, of course, it changes your perspective. You know, I grew up in an 80% Latino community when the border was much more fluid than it is now. But it was always fluid. I think one of the things that we've done, this is neither politically right nor politically left, but just an observation of, as we've left it alone as a third rail and yet sought to protect our borders more and more, we've made it a one-way turnstile. It's much more difficult for centuries, for decades, for sure, along that border. People might come over for 6 months, work at labor that it was hard to find labor for, picking fruit, anything else, and then just go home. Just turn around, and because it was a slap on the wrist if they got caught going one way or the other way, and they would just go one way and then go back. And it really was migratory. We've made it so tough for them to go back and to get back in that once they're here, they stay.
And you do investigate that conflict between Anglo and Latino communities on the border, because so much in America we're usually concerned.
And more than one story, not just in that one. Yeah.
And we're concerned about white and black racial difficulties.
Sure.
Oh, okay, white oppression.
Yeah.
But it is in several stories it comes up. And there are several people with mixed heritage in there.
Sure.
But it almost always seems to be an Anglo father and a Latina mother.
Huh, I didn't think about that. That's maybe because my first girlfriend in high school was Latina, named Debbie Hernandez, who actually edited the Spanish in my book for me. She's now...
That's awful big of her.
We've been friends a long, long time. Yeah, we got over whatever that was long ago. But yeah, I think I grew up in a time period where those barriers were breaking down, but I had no idea what it was like to be brown. and yet 80% of my friends were brown. And I had no idea what trouble could come their way from speaking Spanish, and yet I grew up in a bilingual home. My family had been on the Mexican border for four generations, and my father was adamant that if you did not speak Spanish, you could not earn a living in that town. So I think it was challenging in 1973 for me to be a white guy in that world and date a brown girl, and I think it was challenging for her family as well, for her to be going out with a white kid.
Especially who's not Catholic.
Right. Who's not Catholic. And lots of those kinds of situations. And so I tried to think about as much as possible, particularly in Sycamore Creek, which is one of the references that we're dealing with here, is how much my own upbringing, my own eyesight from what it was like to be a kid in West Texas in the 1970s was like. And, you know, it's the first short story I wrote. So it was, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to mine what you know.
And It Ain't Done With Me, our retired spy.
Yes.
Started off as a military sniper, and his name was Enrique Walker. And I was just wondering if maybe Carlos Hathcock
no.
was one of the Marines' most famous snipers.
Yeah, no, it was not, actually. But I think part of that is from the work that I've done through Songwriting with Soldiers, which is a wonderful charity started by my dear friend Darden Smith. He and I wrote a song called Angel Flight, and it sort of rolled into a charitable organization where professional songwriters go and write with returning veterans. And it really gives them a point of catharsis and a real talisman for, you know, wounds seen and unseen. And I tend to get a lot of the guys who grew up on a ranch, grew up on a farm. The military has a long history of making deer hunters into snipers. And I grew up a deer hunter, you know, so I think about that a lot. And I've met a lot of them. So that was really my motivation, I guess you'd call it, you know, for really discovering that character. And it really was born of creating Enrique Walker, you know.
Now, you're talking about working with Darden Smith, and of course, songwriting can be a very collaborative process.
Sure.
What was it like to be all on your own while you're writing?
Yeah, it's a different
kettle of fish. Like a Rolling
Stone. You know, yeah, I think one of the things that was always helpful for me is that, you know, I started songwriting on my own, and I've just never stopped. I had the habit of setting aside time to write songs on my own, be it that they might take, you know, 3 weeks or 3 months or 3 days or 30 minutes to write. And I had the habit also of setting aside days that, you know, I'm going to write with that guy at 10:30 tomorrow morning. So I think that the fact that I set aside that time and that struggle to write on my own, because I felt like you're not going to get a vision that I have in my head going all the way through if I collaborate on that particular song. You know, I know where this needs to go. I just have to put the work in. So I think that was helpful for me when I started writing on my own. And plus, my first one was because of the necessity of a solitary existence. I couldn't talk to my kids, couldn't talk to my wife. It was frustrating to write notes or to type, you know, text because it wouldn't go as fast as my brain would. So I needed some solitude, and writing did the trick. It was kind of perfect storm. And I really am a believer in that nothing happens by accident. I think God, whoever you may define that as out there in listening world, opens opportunities and doors when we least expect it and in ways that we least expect. And I would not have thought, if you'd have told me when I was 28 that 58 I'd be putting out a book of short fiction, I'd have told you you'd lost your mind, you know. But life and circumstance did that, and then now I have the bug. So it's this other way of expressing myself that I don't want to give up.
But you went to school at Sewanee, so that should have rubbed all the writing off on you there.
Well, it did. The most informative thing about Sewanee's education was that it wasn't just the English department that was going to teach me how to write a sentence. My first biology paper that I turned in had an A- as the first grade and a D as the second grade, with a C as the ending result. And a note that said, come see me in my office, from my biology professor, Henrietta Kroom. Still remember her. She's a lovely woman. And I said, what? I don't understand. And she said, all your research is damn near perfect. And it's a really good paper on that level, but it's like watching paint dry to read. And I'm like, I don't understand. She said, look, I know you're not in English class, but someday, if you become a physician and you discover something that the world really needs to know about, and you write about it in the New England Journal of Medicine, you might want someone to read it. It might need to be interesting enough and enough of a story that you get your point across, and then it can cure something. And I went, oh, okay, I get it. That's a life lesson. And so she said, go rewrite the paper.
I started off a liberal arts school, and I was surprised when I'd write a 12-page paper in calculus class.
Yeah, right. All of a sudden, it's like, whoa. They're thinking outside my normal lines here. It was a good thing.
Now, before we started the interview, you had mentioned that it was an old songwriting partner turned fiction writer, was very instrumental in your early days.
It was. After I had written maybe 4 or 5 short stories, I started thinking about who I could send them to that, you know, would not run screaming for the hills. One of them was Alice Randall, who is a very, very fine author and teaches creative writing at Vanderbilt University. She wrote the parody of Gone with the Wind from Mammy's point of view, known
as The Wind Done Gone.
The Wind Done Gone. And she's a brilliant author and funny, funny woman. And we've been friends a long time. She and I wrote a song called Went for a Ride. She's an African-American woman from the Northeast, but loved cowboy culture and had really done the studying to know that, you know, there was a whole lot of black cowboys out there in the Wild Wild West, and often born out of the fact that they had been buffalo soldiers in the Indian Wars and the cavalry. And then when they mustered out, they needed jobs. And if you could ride and you could shoot, then you could get a job. So we wrote what I think is still my favorite cowboy song that I've ever written. And I still play it many, many nights. I mean, there's not a month goes by that it's not in a set somewhere.
Until they strung all that wire.
No, until they strung all that wire. That's it. So I said, well, maybe I should call Alice. And I called her up, and she said, oh, hell yeah, I'll read a couple of your short stories. When she got them and she read them, she said, oh, you need to do this. Through her and then through a couple other people, I got a hold of a couple of literary agents. Through my friend Judy O'Brien, who's written women's fiction and young adult fiction for years. And I got to all these literary agents, and all of them said, these are really great. Call us when you have a novel, because we can't make any money at short fiction. But I had already in my head this idea of a book of short fiction with accompanying CD of music, of songs, because two of the first stories I wrote were inspired by songs I had already written. I was like, oh, there's a short story in that. The third one I wrote is humorous, and it's all written from the point of view of a little Pentecostal, or as he says, Pentecostal boy who's 9 years old in 1962. So I thought, well, I gotta have a song to go with that one. So I wrote the song, and that was when it really clicked that, no, that's what I should do. And through a series of events, I met Sherry Smith, who's a great author in her own right, and agreed to read some of my short fiction and liked it and was encouraging and gave me some pointers. And then as I rewrote some things and sent them back, she said, okay, what you don't know is that a couple of years ago, my publisher offered me my own imprint. If I ever found anything I wanted to publish, if you want, I'll make a bunch of calls to a bunch of other publishing houses for you. But I'd love for this book to be the first book on my new imprint. And I said, I don't want to work with anybody else.
In the music biz nowadays, with the digital revolution and people just taking songs left and right, corporate sponsorship plays a big deal in making things successful. But I was wondering, with the book, how much did Woodford Reserve Bourbon give you?
None. It's just my favorite whiskey.
It's in like three songs.
Yeah, it's like three four. Stories, yeah. Right? Yeah. I'm like, well, hell, I might as well, you know, name the whiskey. I mean, you know, it's like, who knows? No, if anyone who works for Woodford's is out there and they want to do some kind of tour sponsorship, I'm all over it because it is my favorite whiskey.
My girlfriend was a big Blanton's
fan.
Oh,
yeah. Well, that's,
but it's gotten so pricey.
Oh, it's really pricey. And hard to get. It's been, you know, allocated. You know.
So she's switched over to Woodford's as her backup.
Not a bad whiskey to go to.
I was really impressed with the story and song Belmont and Sixth, because it seems like maybe a more callow writer would have taken the point of view of the homeless veteran
right. Instead
of the person who's clumsily trying to help.
Yeah, that's really born out of personal experience. Nashville has a wonderful homeless person's newspaper called The Contributor. You know, it's a not-for-profit, but it works as a business. The men and women who are homeless are able to, and they can get credit for their first batch, and they get credentials, and they go through a little sales pitch meeting to learn. They are able to sell those papers and make a profit. So when they go and fill out a job application, they don't have to say, yes, I'm homeless, and yes, I'm unemployed. They can say, no, I'm employed. I have a job in sales. Homeless people actually write some of the articles. They pull from some really great writers and journalists to contribute to it. And I knew that there was a guy who was always on the way to drop my son at high school his freshman year. So we would carpool, you know, with him and some other kids. And I would always buy a paper from one of those guys when I could. And then it was very obvious that he was a vet. There's something about their demeanor, the way they hold themselves, his tattoos, lots of things that were obvious signs. And one day he wasn't there. And then the next day he wasn't there. And the next day he wasn't there. And so that really just hit me, you know, hard. I was like, what happened? It could be for very good reasons. He got help. He got some assistance through the VA for mental health issues. He got not only a place to stay, but a better job and didn't have to be on the street. And, you know, there could be one, or he could be dead, you know, and you don't know what any of those are. Which is why the beginning of that story, I felt like it needed to be written from me, the civilian point of view, the guy who's in the warm car. And the realization, it's the reason that the first paragraph is really a one-sentence paragraph, that when the light turns green, the relationship is over.
I just wanted to give you a quick story. You got me in trouble. I got myself in trouble with help from you and Bill Lloyd. When I first started working at an NPR station at the University of Arkansas, I was asked to substitute on kind of like a new age noontime show, and I played Whoa from Version of the Truth, and I played Billy Austin from Steve Earle's record.
Oh, I'll be on.
And boy, did I get chewed out for
that. I bet, yeah. That doesn't, not really quite fit in format there.
Also, I remember the very day that I first heard of Foster and Lloyd. My buddies and I were sitting around watching Nashville Now.
Oh, wow.
They usually ran it in the afternoon, the day after the evening performance.
Right.
Y'all did Faster and Louder, and it just blew our minds.
Oh, wow. Thanks very much.
We used to watch Nashville Now, Yo MTV Raps, and Headbangers Ball.
That's a good musical education right there.
What is a liberal arts school?
There you go.
Now, the cover of the book and the cover of the CD are very similar, but there are differences in between the two. And the cover of the CD looks very similar to a previous CD of yours as well, with the guitar slung across the back.
Oh, yeah. That's something I do by habit a lot. But in this instance, my wife, who's a great photographer in her own right, a great visual artist, really. So my publisher said, you know, what if you had, and she mentioned that picture. He said, you know, where Radney slings his guitar across his back like that a lot. Like when I read at gigs these days, when I read a little section before I play, you know, I just sling my guitar around backwards. So, you know, Sherry said, is there any way that you could, since the first short story for You See the Stars involves a package, is there any way that Radney could have a guitar, you know, in one scene? Can you make him do some, you know, photography trickery magic and, you know, make him have a guitar for the CD and then a box for the book? And Cindy said, I think so. Let me give it a shot. And she set up a screen and a scrim and, you know, went through a bunch of old photos and did all kinds of stuff and weaved her magic, and it worked. Sherry felt like, it's like, well, that's an iconic thing they've seen before. And even if you're in a bookstore and you go, oh, wait, that's Radney Foster. I know that. Oh, yeah, I got to get that book. You know, smart marketing. But also worked for me artistically as a cover. I thought it was very beautiful and harkens back to, you know, what the dreaminess of that, you know, that first story without any giveaways, just one of the more majestic scenes I've ever personally seen in my life of what the stars are like, where you lose all the light pollution, when you can go to far west Texas and there's nothing out there. And it's a really amazing thing.
You amaze me with the schedule that you're keeping at this year's Southern Festival of Books. You have so many events.
I amazed myself. I had no idea. We were just hoping for one, and they just kept asking about it. My publicist is very strong, and she just said, is there another way? Is there another appearance? Is there another? And then they came back and asked. We had gotten just two, and we thought, well, that's good. That's great. Then they came back and asked us for two more. Then last minute they said, will you be a judge on this
literary death match?
Yeah, which I have no idea what it is. So I don't know what I'm judging or walking into, but I hear it's more of a hoot than a real judgment. So
have strong opinions.
Yeah, apparently. I always do. So there you go.
For people who know the festival really well, you're making Ron Rash look lazy. Because Ron comes in and he just loads himself up.
Well, he should, because he's a dang fine poet and author in his own right.
Well, you had mentioned before how they wanted a novel from you. Do you think that's something you want to do now?
I've already started research for one, yeah. I think I needed the 10 pieces of short fiction, and I don't doubt that I'll write more short fiction in the future, but I also know that I need to put my hand to the plow on something that's a little longer form.
Are you allowed to talk about that, or do you need to keep that secret?
No, that's too early to talk about it all.
So. Well, Rad, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your really busy schedule and talking with us today.
Pleasure's all mine.
Radney Foster is the author of the story collection For You to See the Stars, which is published by Working Title Farm. And there is a companion album with a song for each of the stories, also called For You to See the Stars, and it's available from Devil's River Records. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.